Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world naming their dog Red Herring. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and it's all a decoy, baby.
Oh, it is indeed, and we are going to get to the grand reveal of Shohei Ohtani's dog's name, the reveal that it was, in fact, Shohei Ohtani's dog, despite some skepticism of even that being the case. It is Friday. We have so much to talk about because we last recorded on Tuesday afternoon with our dear friend Mike Farron for Prospect Barbacast, and we got a wave of news. We got trades. We got signings. This is finally, this shit's going down. And of course, we are going to lead with more Shohei Ohtani stuff because he was formally introduced to the horde of LA media yesterday at Dodger Stadium. We're going to talk about his contract finally, which is a subject of much discussion. We're going to talk about the trade that the Dodgers not officially completed involving Tyler Glass now, but we seemed like we had the parameters of that. Giants signed Jung-Hoo Lee, a bunch of other moves. And then Jake Mintz, the return of the good, the bad, the ugly. I don't really have an explanation for why we haven't been doing this on the last few Fridays, but ultimately we have enough strange topics, ugly-worthy topics that we decided to bring in here today. So probably going to be a bit of a long pod, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited. And we, as always, I don't know how many more shows we're going to lead with Ohtani, but this will still be one of them.
Shohei Ohtani can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, which is relevant because yesterday he spoke publicly for the first time in 4 months. I believe the last time he spoke was after an Angels game against the San Francisco Giants in early August. After that, he made one more start and then went pop, boom, bow. Yeah. But Ohtani, there were moments of revelation at the press conference at Dodger Stadium. There were moments of obfuscation as well. We were given the runaround on a couple things, and we were given some clarity on a couple things. But you watched it. I read the transcript.
Most of it. Yep. Yep.
I'm curious, what was your visceral takeaway from seeing Shohei Ohtani on the field at Dodger Stadium?
Sure, yeah. And of course, they did the whole photo shoot, and now the Dodgers are really, you know, cranking out the official, no more Photoshops, right? We got the guy in the building, wearing the real jersey, on the field, swinging a bat, all these things. We've already seen some interviews with Dodgers players like Gavin Lux and Joe Kelly talking about how they've already seen him in the weight room and all these things. So he's a Dodger. It's happened. And I was interested, not just, again, all the formal remarks, you know, about from Friedman and so on, like those were all predictable. There says it's a great day in Dodgers history, blah, 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 blah. Like that's all to be expected. But as you mentioned, you know, first time talking to the media in 4 months. And I imagine that there's probably some fans thinking like, okay, what's the big deal? Like, what's he really going to say? But this added a level of anticipation, not because I necessarily thought he was going to, you know, spill his heart and soul to us, but I was excited because especially knowing how many of our friends in the media were there, like, what would the first question be? You know, like I was like, where do you even begin with this? And, you know, Jack Harris started with the very obvious, like, when did you decide to be a Dodger and then why? And we got a lot of those similar questions. But and of course, we'll get to the dog stuff later. And I'm curious, what stood out to you? What of his answers stood out to you? Because there were two that I think kind of caught the most headlines that I think are worth discussing. And then we'll get into his contract, which we still haven't talked about on the show.
The first is that he still doesn't want to call the surgery he got Tommy John. Mm-hmm. When it is Tommy John, like, I don't understand.
They're
picking nits. They're picking hairs here. Like it's Tommy John. He got a reconstructive elbow surgery. Mm-hmm. It's more of a, I think they, what did they say? It was a repair or a revision. It was a revision. I understand it was on the different part of the elbow, but I would imagine that there are other players who have gotten this exact procedure where we reported it as Tommy John and it was discussed as Tommy John. And
that so, I agree with. Yeah.
But I found it interesting that he's still kind of dodging the specifics of that, even though the deal's already signed.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, one of the questions was like, were you not saying it as a form of leverage? And he kind of, now at the same time, like, okay, whether it's Tommy John or not, like, I don't really care. Like, all I want to know is what the timeline is. Like, I don't care what you want to call it, whether it's internal brace, whether it's this. Now, he did say, he said the thing that was, I guess, somewhat revelatory is, he's, and this is why if you do believe him and say it's not Tommy, he said, it was completely different than the last time I got elbow surgery. Okay. So like, I don't know if that's a if that's just a lie. I don't know if this, but like, I don't really care. All we want to know is like, when are you going to be pitching again? And whether or not it was actual full Tommy John is an impact of that, but it doesn't matter what we're calling it. We're going to find out, you know, what kind of, how serious the surgery was based on his timeline of return to throwing and whatnot. But the most important thing is, as he said when he first got it, expects to be DHing on opening day.
The other big news is that he wouldn't talk about the specific other teams. Mm-hmm. I imagine that was out of a kind of a desire for respect and not to embarrass other clubs. But it was clear that he was not interested in talking about that.
That said, though, I do think that, you know, I think that people, I wasn't expecting him to like detail his meeting in Dunedin or whatever. And I, if people were, that's absurd, right? But at the same time, you know, he was asked when he decided, and he said, you know, the night before, you know, that Friday night after the madness where people thought he was on a plane to Toronto, and he was asked about that. And he was like, I was at home. I thought it was funny. Like, that's fine, right? But I think that his answers, and you can choose to believe him or not, did tell me that he did take this process very seriously. And even if the Dodgers always made the most sense from day one of free agency, I do get the sense that he did take the meetings with these other teams very seriously. And the notion that he was just like basically using the Blue Jays and the Giants and whatever, like, I don't buy that. I take Ohtani from the little we know about this person. I do believe he was very thorough and thoughtful in the degree to which he thought about this process. And ultimately, as much as all the rest of us don't want to accept it because some of us don't like seeing super teams formed, like, this was the best place for him. So, like, sorry, like, that's not, we can't be mad that he landed on, he's a smart guy. He landed on, yeah, the Dodgers are the best place for me. Yes, that makes sense.
I would pick the Dodgers too. Mm-hmm. And unless you live in Toronto, San Francisco, Chicago, or Anaheim, I would imagine so would you. It offers him the best combination of everything, and he gets to be in the playoffs every year.
Yeah.
And so I think seeing him in the space with the uniform on was like, oh, well, duh. Like, I still do agree with you, though, that he did the due diligence necessary to make the best decision he could make. The Dodgers' entire setup was just too overwhelming to deny.
Yes. Related to that was, I think, the one other really interesting kind of nugget that he described when he referred to something that, because basically they all asked him, there are way too many of the same questions of like, why the Dodgers, why the Dodgers, why the Dodgers. So he did a good job of trying to come up with different ways to say the same thing. And one of them was his reference. We said, basically when he met with Dodgers ownership, they told, and you know, Friedman and Brandon Gomes, whatever, they said that even though they made the playoffs for the last 10 years, like, and won a World Series, like, they still considered that a failure based on the expectations of the organization. And he said, like, I like that mindset, you know, clearly, basically, like, that appealed to him. He was like, that's what I'm about. To which I was like, if the last decade of the Dodgers is a failure, what the hell's going on in Anaheim? Like, what's the word for that? And you can only imagine what it was like for Ohtani, who did care so much about winning. And I know people said, okay, well, then why did he sign there in the first place? Look, man, like, we've talked about this. Like, he was committed. He wanted to go a place where he could live out this first part of his career and maximize Ohtani the player. And he did it, and it worked, and that's why it was a great fit, right? But now it's like, no, I ain't sitting around here trying to like, this is about, I need to win something, right? Of course, that WB experience, I'm sure, had a lot to do with that as well.
Very Ricky Bobby of the Dodgers to hit Shohei with a, if you ain't first, you're last.
Yeah.
And I love, it's such a hilarious thing, right? It's like, yeah, we've been, what a failure we've been. Right. But at the same time, that's kind of how some fans feel, I bet, in LA.
Yeah. And like, that is a mindset that we wish more teams had, right? Like, that's the whole thing. There is unfortunately way too few teams who are actually viewing the, you know, the point of a professional sports franchise as winning championships. You know, there's plenty that we can point to this offseason. last off, like all around, right? There's unfortunately no shortage of those teams. And so when you have one where it's like, yes, that is the point. And of course the Guggenheim partners care about making boatloads of money. And that's what the Dodgers have figured out. They can marry the extreme pursuit of winning baseball games with making obscene amounts of money. That's good. There's a way to do that. And more teams are capable of doing that than actually do. But that is why they are the perfect landing spot. And also why, as we transition to the contract side of this, why it was clear that Ohtani was like, okay, listen, I'm going to be making so much money no matter what I'm doing. So let's find a way to enable the Dodgers to make this team even better than it already is. And that's when we get to some little discussion of deferrals.
Defer is what you use to make decote.
Okay, but what's decote in this case? I guess decote you were wearing on Wednesday's episode.
Yeah, there was defer in decote from de animals mm-hmm. in de woods. Mm-hmm.
This is a different kind of defer. A very, very different kind of defer. This, again, we've already, I feel like we're kind of past the couple days of the discourse around this. But so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But I mean, it's in one way completely shocking, which is that Shohei Ohtani, when we see the number $700 million, he has decided to defer, literally like 95, 97% of it to after the length of his actual playing contract.
And because of the way that money and time works, the actual value of that $700 million contract is notably lower.
Yes.
Closer to around $470-ish
yes.
million. Dollars.
Yes.
Now, the question obviously immediately becomes, why would Ohtani take this deal? Why do it this way? Why not just get $500 million like a normal guy, right? Like a normal person, and not kick it down the road? Two reasons. One, I think Nez Bilelo at CAA, his agent, wanted a seven. He wanted the seven in front of the number. It's a big fat number. It's easy to sell that, right? And I think that's part of why it dropped the way it did, because it took us time to kind of unpack that. And now most fans just know about the $700 million, right? The second thing is that it does allow the Dodgers to make other moves. Now, there are some in the industry who say, that's not Shohei's problem. He should be making as much money as possible. And by making this agreement with the Dodgers, it sets a dangerous precedent for players, right? Mm-hmm. The other thought from, you know, agents in the game who don't like this deal is that it does not get better than Shohei Ohtani. Like, it will never get better. It will never be a more alluring free agent. And he is, in a way, set a ceiling for what a deal could be. And that ceiling is sneaky, not that high. If you take the value number of the contract at like $470 million, mm-hmm. and that's dangerous. Now, I think Boris is going to go get Soto more than that in 9 months.
Yeah.
12 months. So and so I don't think that's actually a big deal. I do think Scott will get it for Juan. Like, I'm not too worried about that. But just for, you know, the discourse around what this contract is, I think there are a lot of different viewpoints within the game. And people in the know don't really know what to make of it quite yet, because we've just never seen something to this extent. Like, this much deferred money is very new.
It is, but it's actually not. I mean, the amount is new because the total amount is new, no matter what the context is. But I remember the Scherzer deferrals, right? The Nationals are a team that, of course, have done either extreme backloading of contracts or, you know, extreme deferrals. And a huge portion of his first deal with the Nationals, it was the same thing. And I do remember similar levels of discourse. But Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman also have a good amount of deferrals in their contract. This is something we've already seen, you know, with the Dodgers. We just haven't seen it to this level. And so I would say, yeah, like, are there levels to it that are problematic? Now, again, there's a reason why officials are like, oh, MLB's not going to allow this. Like, no, like, the Players Association have kept in the CBA that deferrals can be as much as possible, because, again, you're not thinking about these extreme scenarios until you actually arrive at them.
Yeah. And the Dodgers, let's be very clear about that. Mm-hmm. The Dodgers did not break any rules. Mm-hmm. What they did by giving Shohei the money and the way that they gave it to him is totally fine. Mm-hmm. Totally fine with me. You could argue about the legitimacy of the rule, but it is such a rule that if you can work around it or work within it, you do that. And the Dodgers are well within their rights to do so.
Yeah. I would say, and so, yeah, so the financial side, like, it takes a while to kind of get your mind around it, and it is going to clearly enable, now, again, just because he's making $2 million, that doesn't mean it's a $2 million tax hit, because the total value of the contract is estimated at roughly, as you mentioned, $460 million. That puts the average AAV for the CBT purposes around $46 million, which is still a record, by the way, still higher than Verlander and Scherzer, the ones that they set with their short-term contracts recently, but not to the same degree. Now, at the same time, what's very clear about the Dodgers this offseason as we get to their next move, their trade here in a second with Glasnow, they're going to be blasting into the luxury tax probably no matter what, right? Like, they seem committed to be going in the direction of, you know, Steve Cohen territory basically no matter what. But this does undeniably afford them some level of flexibility that Ohtani himself clearly prioritized, because you say, oh, he's only making $2 million. No, he's going to be making still more than every other baseball player because of what he's going to be having, what he's going to be getting off the field. And based on Tom Verducci's reporting in the immediate aftermath, he had a little anecdote in there at some point where he referred to how Ohtani thought about the money being discussed as laughable, because it is, like, it of course it is. And we can say that about even other big contracts that we've seen in recent free agency. Of course it is, but even for him, like, we know that that is not the most important thing. But as you mentioned, he has an agent, and it's his job to do this, and it's his job for a lot of reasons to get the biggest number, however you get there, and that's how they got there. You can say it's a you know, convoluted mess, but that's part of the negotiation. And in this case, it was extremely beneficiary for both sides. I will say the last part of the contract we did not touch on, unless you have anything else on the financials,
I was literally about to say. So
yes, go ahead.
There is a provision in the contract that if Mark Walter, the owner, or Andrew Friedman, the president of baseball operations, leave their jobs, there is an opt-out triggered at the end of that would allow Ohtani to opt out at the end of that calendar year. The reason for this, probably, is that when he was in Anaheim, there was so much organizational turnover and turmoil that having and guaranteeing himself a level of stability is very interesting to him. But my biggest takeaway here is congratulations to Andrew Friedman on the job security.
Yeah, I am a little confused about the Mark Walter part of this, though, because he is in charge, right? Like, I know the ownership group, Guggenheim, whatever, is a lot of people. But my understanding is he is at the top and the one, you know, making decisions.
I get this. So I think it's if they sell the team.
Right.
Right.
If he chooses to sell the team, right.
If Guggenheim, now that they have all this cash flow because of the way that they're dealing with the Ohtani contract, they could sell the team and make, obviously, oodles of money. Mm-hmm. If there's new leadership that Ohtani's not comfortable with,
also the protection for the people being like, oh, the Dodgers are going to sell before they have to pay Ohtani, you know, $700 million in 10 years. Like, they're going to have to get out from that. Like, no. I understand this a lot. However, it is also just funny because, like, trying to think about the scenario where Andrew Friedman would be getting fired under, like, any circumstance. But it is pretty hilarious. The funniest part about this to me, knowing that it was Ohtani's idea, is, like, when it was broached, Friedman being like, I mean, you know, if you insist, man. Like,
yeah,
I
man.
Guess.
Let me run it up the flagpole. But, dude, here's a hilarious scenario. Ready? Andrew Friedman robs a bank.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you rob a bank and get caught, you probably get fired.
It is a felony for sure. So
yeah, Andrew Friedman robs a bank.
Yep.
Shohei leaves.
but again, it's to be clear, it's his option, right? So
his option. So like, let's say
he's not saying if they are gone, I will leave. It is I can leave.
Right, right. But I love the idea, like, Shohei is like an 11 win player.
Yeah.
In 2 years, right? Andrew Friedman robs a bank.
say they win like two or three World Series in the next 5 years, right? And he's kind of like, you know, mission accomplished. He's like, I'm burnt out, right? He's like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, like,
I'm going to go buy a third division soccer team. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, he just like changes interest and he's like, you know, I'm not really into this anymore. That feels more realistic than robbing a bank, but I don't know Friedman that well. So,
Andrew Friedman, watch Point Break and let me know.
Okay, Jake, let's continue to talk about the Dodgers of Los Angeles, because as the press conference was wrapping up, essentially, basically immediately as it was wrapping up, and we had already had some reporting about this, but it sounds like now we're recording this on Friday morning, 9:30 Eastern. We don't have a final, this is definitely going down, but our understanding is that Tyler Glasnow will be traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers. This will be a trade. Glasnow and Manuel Margot, the outfielder, going to the Dodgers for young right-hander Ryan Pepiot, who's been in the big leagues each of the last 2 years, one of the more promising young pitchers, and an outfielder named Johnny DeLuca, who I'm excited to talk about. But this was a kind of a rumor that sort of percolated over the last couple of weeks. And while I've been waiting, as much as we like free agency, I'm more into the trade stuff. And I was wondering, when would we finally get one of these starting pitchers on the move, whether it was Glasnow, Burns, Bieber, Cease, right? Like there's a couple others out there. And this is, it seems like Glasnow was the one that was being the most aggressively shopped when you compare those. And because the Rays with, unfortunately, and I'm going to get to the Rays side of this in a second, their commitment to cutting down their payroll, they were up way higher than ever before with Glasnow guaranteed $25 million, Margot making around 10. He was not really a part worth being in the mix there. It seemed like that was going to be the first one to go. Now, the Dodgers being the team to do it both makes plenty of sense and also is interesting because we know they are still trying to go after Yamamoto. They still clearly are willing to spend money on other free agent starters. So this is an interesting landing spot. When you saw this return here, and by the way, the other important note here is that it sounds like the Dodgers are planning on working out an extension with Glasnow beyond the 1 year he would be under contract for in 2024. Now, we don't have the details for that. I don't know how much that's going to change my opinion on the trade, but it does make me think about Glasnow and like the risks and rewards of committing to a guy like him. So we should probably start with Glasnow, the pitcher, I think.
So the first thing about Glasnow is, what a strapping, handsome young man.
Yeah.
And that's a good looking dude.
He really is. And also, like
he's very handsome.
He is and this would be true if he didn't, look like Tommy Shelby. Like he is, and what a dude. Like hilarious in terms of personalities and like likable, interesting, like very insult. Like I am a huge fan of Tyler Glasnow. So that makes him very likable in many respects.
Tyler Glasnow thinks about the world beyond his frame of vision, field of vision, in a way that not a lot of baseball players do.
Yes.
And that is part of why he has a tattoo on the inside of his lip and a tattoo on the bottom of his foot, both of which I believe reference various rap songs. I think on the bottom of his foot, he has a tattoo of Old Dirty Bastard, which is both bizarre and hilarious. Glasnow, the pitcher, traded to the Rays from the Pirates in that wild deal way back when. Chris Archer, who now works for the Dodgers. Everything coming back full circle. So Glasnow, what is he? He is a very good pitcher, probably a top 10 pitcher, top 15 pitcher in baseball when he's healthy. That's the problem. Durability concerns. 2019, missed 4 months with an arm strain. 2020 was durable in the 2 minutes that the season was going on. Started a playoff game on 2 days rest, which I had forgotten about, against the Yankees, which is maybe not great. Won both of those games. Pretty cool. Went to the World Series. July 2021, TJ, he had tried to do the thing where he rehabbed it, but just go get the surgery, friends. 2022, came back in August. Remember, was awesome in that playoff game against the Guardians that was a dreadful entertainment watch for the rest of us, but he pitched very well. This year, he had an oblique issue that kept him out until May 27th, and then for the rest of the year, was squarely very good. Very good. Glasnow has gotten better from a command perspective. He is liable to just giving him up in the way that like 2022 Gerrit Cole would just leave a fastball middle up in an advantage count and it would be a home run, right?
Yeah.
That's how he gets beat, when he gets beat. I don't think he is an ace. I think he is a good number two. If he's starting the second, or even, if he's starting the first playoff game for you. It's not the end of the world. If he's starting the second one, that's ideal. That appears like what he's going to do for the Dodgers this year if Walker Buehler comes back healthy. But all the injury concerns with Glasnow, that's expected. I mean, he is a hard worker and gets his body in the best position he can to succeed. Like, he's ripped. But like, when your body is built like that, what is he, 6'7", 6'8", with all those limbs, it's just more parts that can break. There's just more of everything. And so you're going to have a higher injury risk, in my opinion, when you're that tall.
And he's throwing, you know, obscenely hard, right? And he always has. And that's the thing. Like, ultimately, predicting injuries is very difficult, but normally you are going to be concerned about the guys who have repeatedly been injured. And the fact that he just posted a career high in starts and innings with 21 and 120 as he enters his age 30 season, you know, the notion that the Dodgers would commit to him like into his mid-30s is, to me, kind of staggering. At the same time, like, when you catch Glasnow on his best day, I mean, there's very few things like that, because he is throwing so hard. His extension is elite. Not every tall pitcher has elite extension, but he gets down the mound so well, so athletic, and then he can spin the hell out of it, right? I mean, he is, the fact that he's been this dominant, again, and has still, he's in the category of, wow, imagine if he learns a changeup, you know? Now, he's gone a lot farther into his career without really ever even experimenting with that. It's been fastball, it's been curveball, it's been slider, and that's been enough. I'd be curious to see what, it's not like the Rays aren't experimenting with pitch mixes, so it's not like they haven't tried, so, but I would be curious to see if he does make any tweaks with Los Angeles.
That is the thing with Glasnow. It's not as if there's any more developmental meat on the bone. When you are a 30-year-old pitcher going from a very smart organization to another. However, I do think that from an injury prevention standpoint, that is maybe where the Dodgers, their training staff, could do something different to keep him healthier. Here's the thing, I wouldn't mess too much with what he's doing on the mound, because when he is on the mound, it is working. It's more of just like, can they give him something different that's going to make his availability better? We don't know. Who knows? That's not to say that the Dodgers training staff is better or worse than any other. Like, who knows?
Yeah, well, something I want to point out. I would just say, like, it is an interesting gamble for the Dodgers, because they're basically saying, we would rather bet on the guy with the injury concerns who we know is a very good major league pitcher, rather than rolling with our army of guys who either just debuted, including Ryan Pepiot, who we'll talk about in a second. Like, they want to get a little bit more certainty. As awesome as Bobby Miller looked, like, right now, their rotation, though talented, has so many question marks, right? So many. It is, for a team that is, as we know, very, very committed to trying to win a World Series, there are a lot of question marks. Some of those guys are going to turn out to be really good pitchers. Pepiot, Emmett Sheehan, right? Michael Grove. We've still barely seen these guys. Kyle Hurt. There's more coming. Landon Knack, Nick Frasso. Like, all these guys we're going to see in the big leagues. They're saying, no, let's just go get something that, if healthy, they know it's a gamble. It's not like they don't know his track record. We feel a little bit better about the level of performance we're going to get.
And if they hit 500 with their rotation, it's still a postseason rotation. Like, you want to put on rose-colored glasses, and it's healthy Walker Buehler back from TJ. It's firing on all cylinders, Tyler Glasnow. It's Bobby Miller backs up his rookie season. That's an unbelievable top three. That's a great top three. Now, you could also, what's the opposite of rose-colored glasses? Poo-poo-colored glasses. You want to put those on, all right? And then it's Buehler doesn't bounce back from TJ, Glasnow missed time like he always does, and Bobby Miller takes a step back as hitters start to figure him out. And then it's like, uh-oh. Now, yeah,
and that's
some combination of both of these things will happen, and we don't know. But what the Dodgers are doing is putting themselves in the best position for that rotation to succeed. I want to move forward here, Jordan. Mm-hmm. Very quickly on Manuel Margot. Mm. Good defensive outfielder who sucks against right-handed pitching and still really good against lefties.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good fit with the Dodgers because they have so many left-handed hitting outfielders. I would imagine he'll do some platooning with Jason Hayward.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it could be as simple as just platoon with Hayward. I still think they could go after another hitter. I think that the bottom of this lineup, you could still say, needs another guy for the standards that they're trying to hold. And those guys are out there, like Soler, like Teoscar Hernandez, right? There's other options for them too, if they want. But But he could be that. I mean, to me, he's just the outfield version of what they got with Amed Rosario last year.
Yeah.
Whether that's a good or a bad thing, he's more expensive. So in that sense, it's maybe not great, but he's a good fit. I like Margot.
Yeah. Let's talk about the return quickly. Pepiot's super interesting. Pitched in the big leagues in 2022 and then came back up this year in 2023. He made 3 starts, 8 appearances, 42 innings. And was really, really good. He sliced his walk rate quite a bit compared to where he was at in 2022. That jump is probably a little bit of small sample size. It's somewhere in the middle. I would expect kind of average command. The special thing with Pepiot is his fastball characteristics at the top of the zone are really good and really special. And he can miss a lot of bats in zone with that heater. And then the changeup is a plus pitch. I don't really like the slider. I watched a bunch of video of it this morning. It's kind of short, sharp, doesn't get enough separation for the fastball, in my opinion. But the changeup, when he's got it, is a legit, legit pitch.
Yeah, it's been one of the best changeups in the minors for a while now. And, you know, again, when we talk about, I think DeLuca kind of fits this too. But again, this is a third round pick and someone that they developed and have decided that, okay, like, this is the time to cash him in for something that we're getting more certain. Now, Rays fans are right to be excited about getting, you know, 5 years of Pepiot, someone who, again, if I'm going to trust a pitching staff or a pitching, you know, coaching staff, pitching development, to maybe find a way to tweak that off speed or that breaking ball, find a way to, you know, just make enough changes to that mix to where they're doing well. I mean, we've seen them do that with so many guys before. I mean, he's the perfect kind of guy to gamble on. And he's also of that group of young Dodgers pitchers, has had the most actual success in the major league so far. We've actually seen him get a lot of outs and look very effective. So in that sense, I did tab him as probably the one with the most trade value in that sense. And it seems like that's part of why, especially if they're going to get a Glasnow extension done, they're willing to kind of part with someone who clearly was going to be a part of their rotation this year.
I also think that we're going to see, and this is the eternal cycle, Rays develop great pitcher, trade them right before they reach free agency for another pitcher who they develop, and then they trade right before they reach free agency. There's always another Rays beast around the corner. Shane McClanahan is that guy now. Obviously, he's going to be out for most of this year after getting TJ. Jordan?
Jordan,
let me finish my sentence. This is me putting the chips in the Taj Bradley bucket. Just saying right now, I'm all in on Taj Bradley. I love his stuff. I think with a couple tweaks, he's going to be kind of the next in line in the succession, in the dynasty of Rays starting pitchers. Will he reach free agency with the Rays? No, he'll be on the Blue Jays in 2031 or whatever the fuck. But Taj Bradley is legit.
Totally with you. I just, like, it still bums me out that this is how this goes, like, truly. And I know that the Rays have been so good at this that, like, now we just, it doesn't even faze us that we're just trading Tyler Glasnow. And, like, I know that he's not, that he has risks. And with your situation, you have to, and I get it. And like, credit to the front office for continually doing these deals in the right way. But it's still the same way where it's just like, if I'm a Rays fan, like, I probably freaking love Tyler Glasnow. It would bum me out a lot. And so I understand it and I respect the hell out of the front office. I know they're doing it within their means, but the degree to which we just don't even now it's just like, yeah, of course, right, the Rays did that, whatever, we move on. Like, it still bums me out.
When we had conversations about Jerry DePoto and the Mariners, how maybe Jerry just isn't elite at operating within the constraints that are given to him from ownership, the Rays are the opposite. That front office has proven itself elite and adept at making the most of the position that its ownership group is putting it in. You don't think, like, of course, Eric Neander would love to extend Tyler Glasnow. But ownership is saying, we need the payroll to be at here. Here's the budget you have. We're not going above that. And I think as much criticism as the ownership group deserves, I do think that the front office deserves credit for continually making decisions that hit. Because, like, if ownership is coming up to you and saying, we need to get it to this level, you have to trade Tyler Glasnow to do it, like, your hands are tied. Like, you have to make those decisions, and the Rays have continually made the right ones.
Yeah. I mean, that said, if they trade Randy, that's just, an abomination. And that's an abomination. I don't think they will, but yeah.
One more point, as a Rays fan, like as someone who is a Rays fan, I am very sympathetic to the idea that it's hard to fall in love with a team in that way, where if the next player is just going to get yanked off stage and sent away, if the team is staying competitive, that's awesome. But why are you watching the sport? You want to buy a jersey. You want to fall in love with a player. And I have no way to prove what I'm about to say, but I'm curious if, you know, maybe the part of the issue within the fan base is that they are not given players that they can trust are going to be around and care about for the long haul. They were given that in Wander Franco, and I mean, that's its own situation, but like, I think that there's an element to that at play. Whereas if I'm a Yankees fan, like, I have a lot of faith that Anthony Volpe is going to like die in pinstripes, you know? And that makes me more willing to think about him and commit to him as a part of the team.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
Totally fair. So again, discussion of trading Randy, I'm like, oh my God, like this would be a really,
they're not trading Randy version of this. They're not trading Randy.
Also, Johnny DeLuca is really interesting, and in a version of, in the way we talked about with the Yankees, where it's like, look at all these pitchers that they have that you maybe don't realize are valuable to other teams. Johnny DeLuca, perfect example. Total, like, so many of these Dodgers guys just move through the system, put up ridiculous numbers, and then you wake up and you're like, holy shit, look what they're doing in Oklahoma City. Oh, wow, he also has some tools. Oh, wow, he can do this. Extremely adept at pulling fly balls. That's something the Rays really value. We see that in Isak Paredes. Like, I would not be surprised if he is a very, very useful player for them. So, but again, the Dodgers, in their case, they're saying, you know what? Let's cash in that chip. We don't actually know what we have in him at the major league level. And the Rays are more than willing to take that gamble. All right, let's take a quick break, Jake. And when we return, let's talk about the Giants. The Giants making a move. Junghoo Lee. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecast.
Hey everyone, producer Chris here with a brand new housekeeping note about our merch. Basically, we have a bunch of new stuff. So if you've been looking for a Baseball Barbercast themed beanie or bucket hat, or even a t-shirt with one of those cool pockets on the chest, well, you can stop looking and start buying because they are all available right now, just in time for winter. Just go to podswag.com/baseball and don't leave yourself clothesless this winter. That's podswag.com/baseball.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. It's been a weird couple years for the San Francisco Giants. The 2021 season was one of the more miraculous single years I have ever seen in baseball history. An impressive 107-win season, an NL West title that broke the Dodgers' streak, for they fell to their big rivals in the NLDS, in what was like the greatest NLDS I have ever seen. But over the last two offseasons, they have really struggled to land the marquee free agent their roster and their organization needs. We had the Carlos Correa drama a year ago, Aaron Judge using them as leverage to get an extra year from the Yankees, Shohei Ohtani telling them politely to, no thank you, I will be a Dodger. However, the Giants finally caught a fish, reeling in Junghoo Lee for 6 years and $113 million, and opt out after year four of that contract. Lee is an outfielder from the KBO. He's easily the most exciting Korean prospect to come stateside since Ha-Sung Kim. What type of player is this, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why he was kind of more hyped than Ha-Sung Kim, a lot of it is because he is, you know, his dad was one of the great players in KBO history. And also, he had been doing it since basically as soon as he got to the KBO. So this is someone who was basically immediately hitting 300. Now, when you, especially in Japan and the KBO, like, these players get drafted out of high school. And the best ones, unlike here when they get drafted out of high school and they go through the minors, normally when they're good enough, they're going straight to the top level, you know, of their domestic league. And basically, as soon as he arrived with the Heroes, when he was initially teammates with Ha-Sung Kim, he was just one of the best hitters. Immediately was showing a precocious hit tool, never striking out, drawing a lot of walks. And what we've seen over the last 3 years is him start to develop some power. He's shown it in international competition. And then unfortunately, in his last year in the KBO, he fractured his ankle, which cost him the second half of the season. And I think that was a huge... Now, he ultimately clearly didn't end up mattering because he still got a massive contract well beyond expectations. But I think that the hype around him, had he carried... Remember what we saw with Yamamoto where he was pitching, throwing, you know, complete games in the Japan series and all these things. There was a version of the season where he was having a career year, you know, taking the Kiwoom Heroes to the playoffs, all these things where we were hearing about him more down the stretch. But because he was injured, that hype kind of died out. But clearly, there's a lot of interest in him. Like with Yamamoto, this guy's only 25. You don't have the opportunity to invest in a free agent that young very often. And if you believe that not only is he a plus center fielder defensively, but that his bat will translate and also evolve and bring more power as he gets bigger, as he gets older, as he gets stronger, as he maybe adjusts to major league pitching, even if that takes some time, there is definitely an impact player here. And at the very least, there is a giant that I am excited to watch play baseball.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not something that they have had a lot of recently.
The swing itself is very visually pleasing. He kind of, I would describe it as he uncoils in a very unique way where his front leg starts open, but then like comes closed weirdly close to his body where it looks like he's just kind of standing like a regular person. And then it just all kind of shoots forward at once. The big concern here is that he's not going to have enough power. And in San Francisco, I think that concern is particularly valid.
Yeah.
Now, his bat to ball skills are so good that the floor here is pretty high. High contact guy who never strikes out and plays a good defensive center field. That's a valuable leadoff hitter. Now, the ceiling is that he unlocks a little bit more power. He's still only 25, right? So you get this guy on like a weighted bat program or, you know, on a different workout situation and he adds some muscle and he becomes a different type of player. And we've seen this with Kim, where it took Ha-Sung Kim a couple of years to kind of figure out certain parts of his offensive game while he was providing so much defensive value. And this year he posted a 110 OPS plus and was like a very good, solid offensive player for the Padres.
Yeah. And again, though, like I think that that trajectory is going to be very important for Lee. Like, this is clearly a bet that he is going to be an everyday center field defender in the way that, as we saw because of the weird Padres situation, he's been bouncing around to a lot of different positions. But Ha-Sung Kim is an elite infielder at three different spots, right? And so that by itself, you know, supplies the floor and gives him time for the rest of it to catch up. I mean, yeah, admittedly, it's not the best landing spot for projecting his offensive potential. Now you could say the same. I felt the same way about Ha-Sung Kim in San Diego's ballpark. Of course, it's much more extreme in San Francisco. But I'm really excited about this, and it is good to see the Giants finally land someone because again, you have to start somewhere, and they still have a lot more work to do to get this roster into a position where I'm, you know, excited about it. But also, like, yes, it's way beyond what we expected him to get. But if you believe in him as an everyday center fielder who is even an average hitter, $18 million a year is not very much, especially for a team that has cash to spend, right? So sure, when you see, oh my God, that's so much more. I felt the same way about Yoshida when he got his deal. And for him, remember, he had the contact issues, zero defensive value. You know, so there's a lot, it's a lot of a, more of a safety net here with Lee. And he's also much younger than Yoshida was when he came over. So I like this move a lot. It just can't be the only one. It's kind of that simple.
We'll talk a little bit more later about the San Francisco specific city stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's just fly through some moves because there was a bevy of other stuff. Tigers, Jack Flaherty, 1 year, $14 million. This is a pillow prove it deal for Jack Flaherty.
Would you rather have Jack Flaherty for 1 for $14 or Lance Lynn for 1 for $11 or Kyle Gibson for 1 for $13? Because clearly this is sort of the market rate for your 1 year contracts. Now, of course, Jack Flaherty is 8 years younger than Lance Lynn, right? So it's a little bit of a different situation, but we know the risks involved, the injury track record. I've just been underwhelmed watching Jack Flaherty for years now, but I like the fit. I definitely like the fit here, and it is an interesting gamble for the Tigers if they don't feel like they can access the top level of the free agent starting pitching market. They've already added Maeda. It's a nice landing spot for him. I'm just not that much of a believer.
I don't have faith that he's going to figure it out. I think he can be a valuable, dependable starter who's makes starts, I don't think he can ever get back to what he was. I mean, 2019, this guy finished fourth in the Cy Young as a 23-year-old, and it felt like he was just getting started. I don't know if we're going to see that guy again. I don't know if he can move that same way. I don't think the command ever gets back to that level. I mean, he was just walking so many dudes this year. It's hard to be successful when you're walking 4.1 guys per nine innings. I understand Blake Snell did it. He's a unicorn. I wish the best for Jack Flaherty. Of the guys you listed, Kyle Gibson, 1-for-13, not even a question.
I would say the interesting thing about this for me is, at the very least, this is a commitment. Now, as we saw, like, he could just be bad and they'll go in the other direction. But now you look at the Tigers' rotation and you're not giving him $14 million to be, you know, a spot starter. So it seems like Scooble, for sure. We believe in Scooble. He's awesome. Flaherty, Maeda, you bring them in. And now you have three more spots between Manning, Olsen, Mize, Gibson Long, who we saw in the second half. I'm curious how the rest of that Tigers rotation shakes out, because this is a commitment to Flaherty that is going to create, I think, more competition among those younger starters in spring training that I think is going to be interesting to monitor. So nice to see the Tigers keep adding. Like, again, even if we're low on Flaherty, like, I like to see that for sure.
Rangers signed Tyler Molly, who will go down in Reds history as a big old thank you for Spencer Steer and Christian Encarnacion Strand. He was traded from Cincy to Minnesota at the 2022 deadline that netted the Reds just two big league starting position players, and Molly barely pitched with the Twins because he had injury problems.
More than that, they also got Steven Hadjer, who they traded for Will Benson. So just an incredible, I mean, Nick Kroll masterclass through and through for the Cincinnati Reds there. But as for Molly, like, he's good. He did not get to prove it with Minnesota. He was probably the worst timing of injuries there, as the Twins have become very accustomed to. But for the Rangers, a team that we really have not talked a lot about since they won the World Series, it seems like they are not as going to be as aggressive. This is a very smart move for 2025, right? He got TJ in May of this year. He's not going to pitch the start of this year. Maybe he comes back in the second half. But once we get past, you know, they could be losing Eovaldi, they could be losing Scherzer, 2025. Who knows what DeGrom is going to be at that point. This is a nice move for a pitcher who's still pretty young, that if you project him to come back from TJ, like, that's a very good, you know, mid-rotation starter if all things go well and at a very reasonable cost. So we see guys like this who just got TJ get two-year deals like this all the time. I think this is a really nice move for Texas, even if it doesn't help them that much this year.
Heaney's done after this season as well. So that's just, there will be spots for him to make starts if he's healthy. The Kansas City Royals, who employ our friend Vinny Pasquantino, who is getting married this weekend. Congratulations, Vin. Very cool. Well, you have a new teammate. In fact, he is now the second richest teammate you have. Seth Lugo to the Royals, $45 million, 3 years, $15 million a year with a player option for 2026. So I think that'll probably get picked up, I would imagine. So 4 years, $60 million. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty serious deal. And the fact that Lugo, who again has basically done this for one season, but I was really impressed. Like, I thought he was exactly what the Padres could have hoped him to be. And he was in position to now where he opted out. Of course, he had an opt out and look at this. What a fascinating career trajectory for him, I would say. And for him to land in Kansas City is a situation where, especially if you're in Seth Lugo's situation, Seth Lugo, not that Seth Lugo doesn't want to win, but Seth Lugo, if you're going to give him $45 million, like, hell yeah, you know, like, absolutely. You earned that. That's why you went somewhere where you could start and you proved that and you cash in way more than you ever would have as the middle reliever he was before. So really interesting. The fact that he's already, you know, 34, like, very strange confluence and team player. But listen, the Royals pitching was, we already talked about this with Will Smith, so horrible. So if you can get any sort of substantive reliability here, like, thank you. And it's starting to shape into something that if you really squint, you're like, maybe this doesn't suck.
You took the words out of my pie hole, Mr. Schusterman. Cole Reagan, Seth Lugo, Brady Singer, Jordan Lyles. Go get one more starter for me. Okay.
It sounds like they want to. It sounds like they're...
Go get Yamamoto. Okay. Yeah. Yamamoto, Cole Reagan, Seth Lugo. I mean, 1-2-3 in a playoff series. Fire me up, Chuck.
I mean, listen, we can do all the calculations about how much giving Yamamoto $30 million would put the Yankees and Dodgers and Mets into all this crazy luxury tax. Royals still chilling at a $93 million payroll right now. Like, let's give Yamamoto 35 and let's go. Let's go after this AL Central that's here for the taking. So, you know, it sounds like they're also going to add Chris Stratton. Maybe we, as we, hey, what did Vinny tell us at winter meetings? What's the strategy? Sign Aroldis Chapman, trade him for Randy Johnson. Just do that again. I don't know who Cole Reagans is in 2024, but Chapman's still out there. So why not? Why not? I bet Chapman would go back to Kansas City and do it all over.
For $3 million?
No doubt. No doubt about that. So anyway. So, you know, again, same with the Tigers, but a little bit less so. Nice to see them actually trying to add major league players. Because I'm sure for them, it's like, dude, they've been same as the Tigers, and the Tigers were a little bit more respectful this year. This team's been bad for a long time. They are not about to watch another 106 losses.
Congratulations to our favorite owner in baseball, the propane king, John Sherman, who owns the Kansas City Royals. He is the, I believe, fourth or third largest provider, distributor of propane in the United States.
Hot stove,
cooking with gas, finally spending a little bit of that good propane dough on Seth Lugo. Let's move to the Pirates, who yes. are...
Let's just talk about Rowdy Tellez.
So I'll one second.
About, yeah.
I was like, cooking, if the Royals are cooking with gas, the Pirates have two sticks in the woods.
Not Pirates. Well, I'll save some Pirates stuff. Let's talk about Rowdy Tellez. Rowdy Tellez as a player, like, he was kind of becoming a nice little profile. He fit well in Milwaukee. And then, I mean, I'm not totally sure what happened this year. It was interesting. He was one of the guys like, ooh, we're getting rid of the shift. Ooh, maybe this will help Rowdy Tellez. And he's like, no, just kidding. I'll be just absolutely dreadful. You know, gone from Milwaukee and now ends up in Pittsburgh, where I'm sure he'll hit some home runs into the water and that'll be cool. Otherwise, I don't have much to add here.
Pirates, I'm not optimistic.
Yeah. But I'll get sad about them later. The Guardians signed Ben Lively. I only saying this because I spent a lot of time talking to Ben Lively with the Reds this season, and I like him a lot. And also, here is just an unbelievably depressing fun fact about this. First starting pitcher the Guardians have signed to a major league contract.
Oh, since, it's like since like Paul Byrd or like Oliver Perez or like...
Not quite. Gavin Floyd, 2015.
Gavin Floyd.
At like the end of his career. So that's a thing. All right, Jake, let's be done with this segment. Let's take a break. And when we return, it's time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast, an extended episode, but you've earned it, listeners. You deserve it. And so we're going to give it to you straight. Good, bad, ugly. For those of you who don't know about this segment, we say one thing good from the week that was in baseball, one thing bad, and one thing a little ugly, a little weird, a little offbeat, a little bit different. Jordan Schusterman, you're older than me, so you go first. What's good?
My good this week could also qualify as ugly, but I can't believe I'm saying this, but Tom Brady made me smile. I got to be honest. Now, it wasn't Tom Brady on his own. And I understand that this is very much an extreme, you know, capitalistic play where we are making Tom Brady rookie card. Bowman is making Tom Brady rookie cards that are worth tens of thousands of dollars. And it's very much part of a you know, promotional thing. However, the commercial that went alongside with this promotion, which to announce the inclusion of a Tom Brady Expos signed rookie card in the next set of Bowman Draft Chrome or whatever, was just absolutely spectacular. And whoever was involved in putting this together, essentially the premise, if you have not seen it, is the Tom Brady, who was drafted by the Expos as a catcher out of high school and obviously did not pursue that, he pursues that and becomes the greatest catcher in baseball history and wins a bunch of World Series. And this is basically a shot of people in Montreal kind of reminiscing about Tom Brady, the baseball player, including a table that features Vlad Guerrero Sr., Larry Walker, and Pedro Martinez, talking about how Tom Brady would never let them lose except for the Giants, except to the Giants twice. There's so much in this 90-second clip that is worthy of digestion. However, what is your favorite part?
It is a great sliding doors moment. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, it bummed me out for the people of Montreal.
Oh, yeah.
Because the use of Montreal as like almost a punchline. I understand that that wasn't maybe the intention, but it's like, man, the whole city would still exist, or the whole franchise would still exist if Tom Brady had just chosen baseball, right? Obviously, it's not that simple. And obviously, they know that's not true. But there was just a part of it that kind of bummed me out a little bit of like, oh, what could have been? Because yeah, it's true. Like, if Tom Brady and the Expos won the 1997 World Series, like, they might still be there, you know?
Yeah.
They might have a new stadium.
I also love that, like, if you look, like, and I don't blame them at all for fudging this, because it makes all of this fantasy way better. You know, the Expos careers of Vlad, Larry Walker, and Pedro did not quite overlap to the same degree. But if they had Tom Brady as their franchise catcher, perhaps they all would have stuck around and really, like, they did. They were all there, but it was just not perfectly aligned. But all of the little newspaper clippings that they've come up, and if you pause and you read some of them, and of course the stuff about him hitting 649 home runs as a catcher is unbelievable. Like, so much incredible stuff. And it's just, yeah, it's well written. It's very funny. And also just the notion that they're implying that he won 7 World Series and then also lost 2 more to the Giants is also amazing.
Jordan.
But also not possible because of, I think, what you're about to say.
They're both in the National League.
They're both in the NL.
Both in the NL. But
I guess
also,
that didn't have to be in the World Series, I should say.
Yeah, in the NLCS. Yeah. Larry Walker left the Expos in 1994, was his last year, went to the Rockies in 95. And Tom Brady was drafted in 95. So at the time Tom Brady was drafted, Larry Walker was already on the Rockies.
Yeah. Yeah, again, there's some, it's not, but like, I don't care because seeing it like it, and that's why it's funny, because when I first watched it, I was like, oh, Vlad, Larry Walker, and Pedro. I was like, wait a minute. Like, if they all played together, I would have known that that was a
you're
thing.
You're like, they should have been so good.
Right. I was like, that's an interesting enough alternate reality on its own, like without Tom Brady. So
Did Vlad never overlapped with Larry Walker? They were never teammates.
Yeah. So anyway, and you could see they're like all wearing like multiple World Series rings. It's anyway.
The attention to detail is amazing.
If you haven't watched it, send us an email after you do and let us know what your favorite parts are. BaseballBarbecast@gmail.com.
I didn't think someone could make me like Tom Brady.
Yeah.
And they did.
But I was like, you know what? It's fine. Well done, Tom. Nice work.
Good job. Good job, Tom.
I guess all he had to do was, I don't know how much of this was CGI versus him, you know, posing in photos of Expos jerseys, but all he had to do was, you know, wake up when the alarm rang at the end of the clip. So I don't know how much of a heavy lift it was, but it was very well done. So good stuff there. Jake, what is your good this week?
Decoy the dog.
Decoy the dog.
Mm. The dog was a decoy the whole time. Shohei Ohtani had the dog.
I knew it. I said, as soon as I saw, when we had the sequence, when Ohtani dog reveal followed by, sorry, I can't speak after winning the MVP, I was like, oh, but everyone's talking about the dog. It's just the ultimate distraction. Nobody cares that Ohtani has now, you know, dodged the media for the third month in a row, even though he just won the MVP, because that is what happened. But it was like, who cares? Like, look at this dog. This dog's adorable.
Jordan knew that the dog's name was DeCopen all along, which I'm probably mispronouncing very poorly.
Yes, so
the dog has a Japanese name and an American name. Mm-hmm. Ohtani said that he gave the dog a Japanese name because he's Japanese. Okay.
Oh,
and
so interesting.
Yeah. And so, but then he gave it an American name because us Gaijin are stupid and can't pronounce things right, and which is also true. And so he gave it an American name, which is Decoy. The name DeCopen in Japanese means to flick one's forehead, is what it appears. So
that's
it's just
a great
like
example of like you know, we have this with like German. It's like, damn, like there's all these words in these other languages that just mean the most specific thing. We're just, we're struggling here. This simpleton English language is just not doing it.
We're just still trying to sound out GH as a hoof, and it doesn't really make any sense. Anyway, the Otani's dog being named Decoy was great. And like, just great job. Good job, Shohei. Yeah. This is a big fat win. No notes. Carry on.
Yeah. Yep. Good stuff. All right. What is bad this week? I already started to allude to it. You did too. The Pirates. What is going on in Pittsburgh? Like, sure, Rowdy Tellez. I understand as we talk about the Rays. Okay, we're operating within our means, whatever. They made a very strange trade, reportedly, where the Yankees, who signed Billy McKinney, okay, it's just Billy McKinney, to a minor league deal, have traded him to the Pirates for international bonus pool money. Pirates just signed Billy McKinney. Is that hard? Now, it's also a funny bounce for Billy McKinney to return to the Yankees, where I'm sure he was like, I'm going to find my way back onto the New York Yankees. And they're like, yeah, sorry, actually, we'd rather have an extra couple grand to give to some, you know, 16-year-old Venezuelan instead of having you get any amount of playing time for us, which makes sense for the Yankees, but it's also like they did sign him in the first place. Why the Pirates are doing this, and also we got news that their catcher, potential catcher of the future, Andy Rodriguez, had Tommy John, so he's going to be out for this year. More time for Henry Davis is great. I believe in Henry Davis, but I'm just looking at this roster, and I'm thinking about, again, and I've thought about this a lot this season in relation to the Reds, and we compared those rebuilds, and I'm just like, man, how are we getting this team to be in the mix at all anytime soon? And I'm struggling to see it, and it's making me really sad. And I know there are some teams that we just don't think about during the offseason, but sometimes when I zoom in and I pull up that roster resource page and I think, how is this team going to be good anytime soon? I'm really struggling to do that with the Pirates, and it's bumming me out, and that is bad. There's my bad.
Playoff sooner. Royals, Pirates.
Oh, Royals, I think. I mean, that Chris Stratton deal. But no, but honestly, like, I feel better about competing in the AL Central versus the NL Central. But again, like, both the Royals lost way more games than the Pirates this year. And still, like, I just, man. So anyway, I just hope O'Neill Cruz comes back and is awesome, because otherwise it's going to be tough. Sorry, Buccos fans. What's your bad?
Let's keep it Rowdy Tellez focused.
A lot of rowdy.
So this actually started what I'm about to talk about. Buster Posey was quoted in an article at The Athletic that he believed there's an uneasiness amongst MLB free agents to sign with the San Francisco Giants because of the city of San Francisco. Because of the perception of the city of San Francisco, that San Francisco is not safe and it's not clean and it's dirty, whatever. Okay. I think Posey's comments were totally fine. He was expressing a sentiment that does exist, like 100% does exist amongst players. Okay. Then Rowdy Tellez went on foul territory and was like, kind of shat on San Francisco a bit. I'm going to just read the quote. For me, the city, man, it's just bad. We grew up taking BART into the city and all that. The last 10 years, so BART is the transportation system. Last 10 years, it's just been a bad city. It's not nice anymore. It's not clean. It's hardly safe. First of all, Tellez is from San Francisco and not from, or sorry, Tellez is from Sacramento, not from San Francisco, which many people have pointed out that those are different cities. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing is, Jordan, if you do MLB cities by crime rate, do you know where San Francisco ranks?
Probably not that high. I mean, I think boiling it down to stuff like that is both extremely reductive and silly, and also, unfortunately, how some people think about this.
Yes.
Especially, well, players.
San Francisco, by violent crime rate, is the 19th highest crime rate amongst MLB cities. So, obviously, there are more complicated ways to assess the health and well-being of a city, but the idea that San Francisco is this like lawless, unsafe madness, like mad. It's just not true and insulting, and
yeah, I mean,
very kind of classist. And like, that being said, this is a sentiment that does exist amongst players. It does. That is totally true. However, I think the Giants are kind of maybe leaning on it a little bit too much as an excuse. You should just be able to go to a player and say, you're uncomfortable with San Francisco, whatever. Go live in suburbia in a big freaking house 30 minutes away. It's how is that any different from any other major American city? All these players, very few of them live in the cities that they play in. Most of them live out in suburbia. And I just am very interested why San Francisco specifically is having this issue. I understand that like there's a narrative that San Francisco is this like unsafe, disgusting city, which I disagree with. I'm just curious for your take on this.
To me, I think that when we're talking about free agent cases, we talk about, oh, they have a geography problem. Well, oftentimes it might be that they'd rather live somewhere else than that they don't want to live there, or they'd rather play for this team than they like. These are all, we take these individual cases and we decide, oh, no one wants to come here. Now, I don't think Buster Posey's making it up, but I also don't take that as an excuse from the Giants as to why they can't land. Like, I think that's a little bit of a stretch. And remember, Buster Posey, the context of these comments was him saying, this is disappointing. I love this city. I moved back to this city. They moved back. When he retired, they moved back. His family moved back to Georgia. And then we're like, no, we missed the city. We're going to go back to San Francisco. Again, it's going to be different for every player at different stages of their lives. Ultimately, this is a situation which you could apply to many other conversations about how people talk about cities versus other places, is that people will see what they want to see and believe what they want to believe. And they'll come up with the stat that they want to believe in. They think, and then thankfully, you have people like Logan Webb who are like, this is ridiculous. I love this place. As you will, of course, find many people in San Francisco. So to see Rowdy Tellez's comments is disappointing for a few reasons. But unfortunately, this is just kind of where we're at in the way that people will. I agree. It is probably a narrative among players, and those players are going to believe what they want to believe. It's not something that I think the Giants are doing wrong, but I also think it's overblown, and there's more reasons why players are going there or not going there. So,
but it's don't be surprised. Yeah. Don't be surprised that a bunch of rich, predominantly white dudes are scared of San Francisco. Like,
yeah. So not shocked. It's that part's of course disheartening, but This is, of course, an issue that extends. The fact that this is a kind of conversation we're having in a baseball free agency context is, I think, not like the baseball free agents are not the most important part of any discussion about what makes a city and how cities can become, can thrive and whatnot.
Are you sure? I think that's exactly what it is.
I feel pretty good. But I also, again, having been to San Francisco once in my life, I am certainly not going to say anything about it in one way or the other.
I will be in San Francisco 1 week from today for next weekend. So I'll report back.
I'm sure you will give us the final answer. And you will determine whether it is a good city or a bad city.
Final answer.
Rowdy Tellez has decided bad city. It's like, all right.
Bad city. Rowdy Tellez says bad. Jake Mintz, I'm going to tell you right now. I'm going to say good.
Also, it's like people are like, oh my God, Rowdy Tellez is like, okay, that's Rowdy Tellez. We've talked about whatever. Why is his opinion? Who gives a shit, right? Like,
what is Ja Rule going to think at a time like this?
Right. I mean, it's important, and I understand Major League Baseball players comment, like, it becomes a headline and then it becomes a narrative, and then, like, that's problematic. I get that. So I don't want to, like, dismiss that. But whatever. Like, people of San Francisco, like, you should be proud for all, as you should be if you live in any city with whatever problems it comes with.
Correct. If you live in San Francisco and you're proud of living in San Francisco, you didn't look at Rowdy Tellez's comments and be like, you know what? He's right. Like, yeah. No.
So anyway. All right. Let's get to Ugla before we say goodbye. My Ugla this week. It's courtesy of baseballreference.com.
That's a good website.
We all get our, Spotify Wrapped and whatnot, and Baseball Reference produces something vaguely similar in terms of a year in review of just a very collection of data and maps that tells us things about what part of the website people in different parts of the country were visiting most frequently. And you can find, they tweet out the link with all the graphics. I think they tweet a thread of it. But I just wanted to kind of throw it to you here. And again, we have basically a map of the most viewed player pages in each state, including Canada, which is not interesting because every single one's Ohtani. Most viewed team pages by state. Like, I always enjoy this. And then, of course, the top 10 players. I think it's the most interesting thing every year, which players' pages were visited the most in an individual year. So where do you want to start here? Because there's a lot of fun stuff.
I am interested in the non-obvious players by state, right? So much of the map is Ohtani. And so for me, it's who breaks through to be relevant enough in their specific location to be more relevant than Shohei Ohtani? And the answers to that question are Corbin Carroll in Arizona, which is freaking cool. Julio in Washington State, which is cool as hell. Acuna in Alabama and Georgia. Judge in New York and New Jersey and Connecticut. Yep. Harper in Delaware and Pennsylvania. Makes sense. Christian Yelich in Wisconsin. Yep. And then Miguel Cabrera in Michigan. All of those make a lot of sense. The one that is so funny and so sad to me is Luis Arraez being the most viewed player page in North Dakota and Minnesota, where Twins fans were probably like, damn, he's hitting 400
right, for the Marlins? Right. It was really that simple. Again, Pablo Lopez, freaking awesome, right? Like, not a bad trade. But because specifically he was the guy hitting 400,
people were checking it every day.
It was every day for the first. Like, that had to have tailed off, you know, after June. But North Dakota Luis Arraez is just an incredible thing. But literally every other state is Shohei Ohtani. No surprise there. So I feel like we've had years where there were more surprising ones. They've done this for a few years now. This was pretty standard across the board. No shock. I was a little bit surprised that no Rangers or Astros broke through in Texas. That surprised me a little bit, just knowing, obviously, the year the Rangers had, and also just the Astros, how passionate Astros fans are. But Ohtani, too much to overcome. Now, of course, Ohtani was the most viewed individual page, duh. But the rest of this list I also found quite interesting. So the top 10 players were, number one, Ohtani. Number two, Mike Trout, still amazing. Three, Judge. Four, Acuna. Five, Barry Bonds. Six, Juan Soto. Seven, Miguel Cabrera. Eight, Mookie Betts. Nine, Justin Verlander. 10, Bryce Harper. What surprises you about this group of 10?
I thought Cabrera would be higher just because he was retiring and it was like a farewell and people were probably just checking. I thought people would just be checking his stats the whole year. So that was
surprising. Him still being here is pretty, even seven. Like this is about where I would expect him. Like, he's definitely on here. I mean, Acuna behind, like, I think I would have expected Acuna to be ahead of Judge. And Trout, I guess. I mean, Bonds still being in the top five is just like so incredible on so many levels. Like, that is, it's honestly validating in a way. Because it's like, oh no, like, I'm not the only one just like routinely.
It's like, oh, this thing I'm looking at all the time, it's not just me. Like, oh, you watch that TV show too.
I don't mean in the sense that like I'm the one driving up the view count. I'm saying like clearly not, you know. I felt like this, here's the thing. I think this was probably the year I looked at Barry Bonds' Baseball Reference page the least. Mm. And he was still top five. So anyway, and then Trout being two is just, I mean, I tweeted this, but it's basically like being like, oh, if he could just get back. Like, I want to believe there's still another chapter of Mike Trout being one of the best players in the league. And I still believe that. But it's this was the first year where his stats were, like, not amazing. He was just, like, good and injured. So other than that, though, I mean, everything else pretty much tracks, I would say. So these are great. Anything else from this before we get to your
No. Own? No.
Okay.
One place.
Check it out. Very good. We love Baseball Reference.
One place that's not on this map is Tulum, Mexico.
Probably still Ohtani was the most viewed.
Why did I bring up Tulum? Because we had a little wedding. This is from Vogue. Vanessa Hudgens wore Vera Wang to marry Cole Tucker in the heart of the Mayan jungle. Vanessa Hudgens is very famous. She was in High School Musical. She has 51 million Instagram followers. And she married someone whose phone number I have.
Damn.
Cole Tucker, who was a top prospect for the Pirates, made it up to the big leagues briefly, spent some time in the minors with the Rockies and the Diamondbacks, and is one of the most interesting, enjoyable people we have ever interacted with in this big world of baseball. He was on our Backyard Baseball Power Hour during the pandemic a couple months before he first met Vanessa Hudgens, who he just married in the heart of the Mayan jungle. Okay? They got married. The pictures are incredible. The idea that, respectably, like, a well below average major leaguer is now married to Vanessa Hudgens is just hilarious. The way that they met is funny. There were tweets from Cole Tucker from like when he was in high school, basically being like, one day I want to meet Vanessa Hudgens. Like, that would be awesome. I'd love to go on a date with her. Now they're married. The pictures are great. Cody Bellinger was there. There were like 85 people in Cole Tucker's wedding party, including his brother, who's a minor leaguer, including Scott Kingery, including Pirates starter Mitch Keller. It's all very great. So happy for Cole, happy for Vanessa on their nuptials.
Yeah, it's and here's the thing. While Cole Tucker's, you know, baseball career is maybe not as he expected, like when you if you meet him and have met, like, it's like, oh yeah, like the notion of him meeting and wooing a famous person is like the least surprising thing of all time. He is as charismatic and likable as it gets. So congrats to them. But these pictures are just absolutely hilarious. I mean, Cody Bellinger and Mitch Keller, when they face off this year, we'll have to crop them standing next to Cole Tucker in their groomsmen outfit. Very, very funny stuff. All right. Congrats to them. Congrats to us, Jake, on a great podcast. Truly.
Big pod.
I know
big
we
pod.
Went long, but that was a lot to cover. We'll be back on Monday. Maybe Yamamoto will be on a team. I don't really know the timeline of that. That one is getting pretty interesting.
If you want to marry us in the heart of the Mayan jungle, you can ask us to do so at baseballbarbacast, barbcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. Don't do that. You can, but we probably won't respond.
No one's ever the outskirts of the Mayan jungle. It's always the heart of the jungle. It's, you know, it's
has to be. And you can, you know, get your Barbacast merch. I know we got Hanukkah just wrapped up last night, but Christmas coming up. Podswag.com/baseball if you want Barbacast merch.
If you have any other High School Musical weddings to attend, you could wear our merch to that.
Yes. They'll definitely understand. But thank you all for listening. Thank you to Isabella Joseph for producing, as always, because Isabella will be with us for the next little while Chris is on vacay. Well-deserved vacay for Chris Tyler. We'll be back on Monday. Hope everyone has a wonderful weekend.
And don't forget.
Yeah.
We're all in this together. Cole Tucker, congratulations.
Yeah. Jake, a wise man once said, Jake, stick to the stuff you know. We don't need you singing. Goodbye.
Boy!
SiriusXM Podcasts.